Blog Talk Radio.
You love the movie geeks, and we love you right back. And to prove it, we're going to be delivering to you tonight your own Valentine. That's right, My Bloody Valentine 3D. From that film, we'll be discussing the cinematography with Brian Pearson and the music score by Michael Wandmacher. It's all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. This is Movie Geeks United. I believe we are on the air. We had some technical difficulties. Jerry, are you with us?
I can hear you.
Okay. Does my phone line sound terrible?
No, it's fine. I couldn't, okay. You know, I was trying to call back in. I couldn't get back in for the longest
okay.
time.
Well, I think we're here now. The phone connection was really wacko
yeah,
when I started it, so... I think we're okay now. If anyone in the chat room can tell us, once you guys log into the chat room, just click the chat available icon there on the homepage where you're listening in, and it'll take you directly to our chat room, and you can have a lot of fun talking about tonight's film in there with fellow fans. So how are you, Jerry?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm actually doing pretty good. I'm looking forward to tonight's show. I didn't get to sit on the interviews, but I'm looking forward to hearing what they have to say. I didn't talk to, but on Horror Yearbook, Will's show the other night, Will and Molly spoke to Todd Farmer, the screenwriter
right.
of the film, and it sounds like, you know, this might be the smart way to do a remake with the 3D technology and everything, so.
Yeah, and from what I've read, from the talents involved and from what I've heard from speaking with them, it pushes it over the edge. It makes it an event picture.
Oh, big time.
Yeah. And I, for one, am looking forward to it. I'm going to be there with my family, my brother.
Yeah.
I'm taking my children.
You're taking the nieces and nephews, everyone.
Right. I'm going to be there Friday night with a big bag of popcorn and the glasses, and I'm just going to sit back and have a great time, I think.
Sounds like it, definitely.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Welcome to the chat room, to any listeners out there. We urge you guys to log in there during the show. It's great fun. We got a couple things to talk about before we start on in these interviews. The first major thing, we left off Sunday before the Globes, and now we're post-Globes. So what were your impressions of the evening, Jerry?
Well, my impressions of the evening when I wasn't watching 24, and I have to say, no, I watched both, and I definitely watched the last hour of the Globes. Nothing, I can't say anything, well, all right, one real surprise, that was Colin Farrell for In Bruges. I did not think,
right.
I thought he and Gleason would cancel each other out, but I was very happy to see Colin Farrell get it. That's the one thing that truly surprised me, though.
Yeah.
Anything surprise you?
Pleasantly. I mean, I was pleasantly surprised that Kate Winslet got a double win.
Yeah.
I was pleasantly surprised that Vicky Cristina won over Mamma Mia.
No, that was nice. That would, yeah, definitely, because Mamma Mia was looking like the favorite there for a while.
Mm-hmm. So I had no problems with the winners.
No, and I thought it was great. Mickey Rourke, you know, that was beautiful. And Heath
yeah.
Ledger, that was another, though, you know, I don't see how the supporting actor could go any other way.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think there would be major outrage, and I think anyone who's nominated in that category, you know, would just say no. This is for Heath. I mean, I don't see
yeah.
how else you can do it.
He's going to win the Oscar. I mean,
yeah,
and everybody, even those nominated in that category, knows that this is Ledger's year to sweep, and I'm sure that even if he were living, it would be the year. I mean, I don't think it has to do with his death.
Right.
It's not that kind of win. It's a deserving win.
Oh, it's a very... I think it's for a whole... let's be very honest, for a whole body of work, a legacy. Not just a death, but I mean, there's a whole bunch of great roles there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it does run the risk of... That's why it's a little difficult. It does run the risk of being kind of... What's the word for it? Passé. Because when you remember when Jamie Foxx swept every single award.
Right.
And every time it was the same speech. So, and the same kind of humming of the Ray Charles thing.
Right, right. Well, I think
yeah.
it's hard. When you're going through that, I think it's hard to... God, I would imagine, like, with anything else, there's got to be burnout.
Yeah.
I know, even though you're getting all these accolades and everything, it might get tiring after a while. But I think, though, going on to... I do think it is Slumdog Millionaires to lose. I think it's a you know, foregone conclusion that this film is going to sweep the Oscars.
Uh-huh.
I really do. I would be really surprised if it doesn't. Just the way the Producers Guild and Directors Guild nominations have been so far, I just think it's this is the movie of the year.
Well, you know, I am not of the opinion that it's deserving of the best.
Oh, movie. I don't think. Yeah, I mean, I just think this is the year. Look, I didn't even put it in my top 10 list. I like it a lot, but I just saw other films that really moved me more. But it is I think it's a very well done film. It came with so much advance anticipation when I saw it. Everyone was talking about this. Yeah, it's good. I don't have any problem with it. I just saw other films I liked more.
Right.
But let me ask you this, though, because what did you think of Danny Boyle winning?
I thought that was fine.
Yeah, I mean, I also
I like Danny Boyle.
I love Danny Boyle, and I think it's like he's a very versatile director, and I like to think that there's a lot of, like, Trainspotting, Shallow Grave, Sunshine, Millions, 28 Days Later. I mean, this guy's done everything, every genre now, it seems, so I think I thought that was very encouraging. I liked that.
And typically you would think that a best picture should go to the best director. I mean, that doesn't happen always, of course. Sometimes the directors aren't even nominated. You know, you would think that those go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you'd hope so anyway.
Yeah. But in some years that hasn't happened, obviously.
Oh, yeah. I think Fincher deserves it in terms of scope and ambition.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my take. And you'll be able to hear all those takes on our Oscar roundtable.
Yeah,
I'm not a Slumdog
hater.
I love Slumdog.
No, we're not haters at all. Yeah. I think that's what. Oh God, this is like, you know, I think this is if any year is of the little film that could, this is possibly that year where Juno didn't do it and Little Miss Sunshine didn't do it. This is the strongest case to be made that this is the little film that could.
It's one of those things, though. It's one of those movies that people are so protective of. If you say one little bad thing about it, you're shooting their puppy or something.
Yeah, I know. I know.
You got to be careful.
You got to be very careful. I mean, I'm afraid Nicholas Vargo is going to come, like, you know, like just like slice me up or something.
Yeah. Anyway, big news today. We lost someone today in the film community. Yeah, we did. And the first one is Ricardo Montalban. Occurred today.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, Mr. Rourke from Fantasy Island, but I mean, a very long, distinguished TV acting career, and also films too.
Right.
Star Trek. You know, the TV series and the movie. Wrath of Khan. He played Khan, possibly the best villain I think in the whole series. Also in the Planet of the Apes movies, he's in two of them. He plays Armando, the circus trainer who rescues the Roddy McDowell Caesar. And raises him after his parents are murdered. So, and the Naked Gun and the Spy Kid movies as well.
He was always a part of my childhood because I mean, I watched Fantasy Island, but of course the Star Trek II.
Yeah, but also Fantasy Island though, that was a big Saturday nights. That the Love Boat and that. I mean,
yeah. And he was he was delectable in Wrath of Khan.
Mm-hmm.
And by all accounts, just a true gentleman.
Yeah, he was always professional. Always.
Yeah. And the other talent we lost today.
Is Patrick McGoohan, very, very great actor. I know from the TV series The Prisoner, one of my favorite TV shows of all time, and before that there was Secret Agent Man. And he turned down the role of James Bond when it was offered to him after Sean Connery left. He turned it down. He just didn't want it. But he was in a lot of movies, Ice Station Zebra, Scanners, Braveheart. I believe he's the judge in A Time to Kill, if I'm not mistaken.
Hmm. Yeah.
But
well,
he was a great, great actor. Wonderful, wonderful actor.
Yeah, so we lost two good ones today. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about the positive. Let's talk about My Bloody Valentine 3D. Now, are you checking this out this weekend?
Yes, I am checking this out. I think this and Defiance are my films this weekend.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's quite a combo.
That is really talk about you're gonna. I was gonna need an upper after seeing both of those.
Right.
Or maybe
right.
While watching both, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think Bloody Valentine is gonna be an up experience. So let's get to the interviews. Our first interview that we'll play for you guys comes from the cinematographer of the film. Now, this has received major press, mainly for the fact that it's shot in 3D, and this is a new revolutionary kind of technology that is much improved over what we know from 20, 30 years ago. And so to talk about the process of shooting in 3D and everything that goes into that, and digital video as well, this made for a great conversation. This is Brian Pearson, the cinematographer of My Bloody Valentine 3D, and here we go. First of all, in terms of the 3D technology, had you had any experience with the new 3D technology prior to coming on board this film?
Before I started working on Bloody Valentine, I had no experience with 3D technology, so it was quite an intensive prep period, as you can imagine. It's also a digital film, and I had shot some digital, but it was done with the red cameras and another set of cameras called the SI2Ks.
Mm.
And so there was a lot to learn, including the 3D and the digital and all of it together.
And what kind of time frame? The cinematographer is usually brought in rather early in an ideal situation, isn't he?
Yeah, I had about 6 weeks of prep ahead of time. And I also went in on my own to Paradise Effects, which is in Van Nuys, California, and spent my own time there just getting to know their systems and getting to know the people that we'd be working with and collaborating with on this project. I spent quite a bit of time with them. The problem being, of course, that the rigs that we ended up using on the film weren't ready until about a day before we started shooting.
Oh.
it's very new technology at
right.
the time, and certainly, even as we were shooting, there's a lot of R&D going on and just some changes to the various rigs.
Well, let's talk about the 3D aspect of it first, and then we'll get into the digital technology, because both of these are trends that I think, obviously, it's already happening with the digital, but in terms of 3D, I think it's going to be more and more prevalent in films. I understand that the technology is much different and much improved since the olden days, the 3D technology from back then. What's different about it? How is that? I think it's called Real-D technology. How does that work exactly?
Well, I saw Friday the 13th 3D in the theater. Was it 1981, early 80s? And it was with the magenta cyan glasses. And I think when you walked out of the theater, you had a 3D experience, but you also had a pretty good headache. those films were shot in 3D with film cameras. They were very cumbersome, some of the same problems that we have with digital cameras. But the new 3D has a lot of benefits that are different from the way those films were made. First of all, everything is digital, and there's a lot of work in post-production that can be done to converge the 3D so it's much easier to watch. Mm-hmm. And the other benefit we have is that when we shoot on set, we can see the 3D live. And the next day we can also see the 3D in dailies, whereas I think in the past they had to wait for a certain amount of time to be able to project that kind of stuff and to be able to see it. And the cyan magenta glasses are now gone, and they use a polarization method. Real-D, and there's also a Dolby Digital, they each have a different method of decoding the 3D into your brain. But I believe that Real-D uses polarized lenses so that one eye polarizes out the image that's on the screen, and the other and the right eye sees it, for instance, and then the left eye would see the next image, and it sort of flickered back and forth like that. The Dolby system, I believe, has a shuttered glasses system, so your glasses actually are actively shuttering one eye dark and then the other eye dark back and forth.
But in terms of crafting the look of the film, now you talked about Friday the 13th Part 3, the 3D version of that. Those movies that were made 20, 25, 30 years ago, they really played up on the 3D gimmick, where it was shot particularly for a 3D effect of, you know, whether it's the shark fin coming after you or what have you. Is it a fine line between going with what works for the film itself and bringing out the best of the 3D as a cinematographer and crafting the look and the shots in this?
Well, from the beginning, this film was a real partnership between myself and Patrick Lussier, the director, and he was very intent on not just making the film about 3D gags. He wanted a strong story, terrific actors, and also to let the movie play in this sort of a new immersive 3D environment, as well as pulling out some things out of the screen. I think the gags are typically known as outies, like things that come out at you. And
right.
What we found the more we shot is that the 3D isn't about the outies, it's about the whole immersive quality. It puts you in the environment, which I think is even more terrifying than watching something in 2D, where I feel like you're looking at something flat, whereas in the 3D, if you sit in the right place in the theater, I think you get this really immersive sense of it, so that even the grocery store aisle takes on this incredible 3D quality. And people are saying, you know, what are the 3D moments? Every single moment in this film is a 3D moment because the entire film is shot in 3D. You don't need something poking out of the screen at you to enjoy it. It's there all the time. And every shot, you know, we carefully designed the shots as best we could to have depth and to have an immersive quality. The film takes place in a mine, so already you're dealing with long tunnels that trail away into the distance, you know, light bulbs back and forth here and there that give a real sense of depth. So we were in a terrific environment, and it was a terrific idea to do this particular film in 3D, as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly what did you see?
Something was following us.
This is the most horrific event this town has ever seen. Authorities are calling this the Valentine's Day Massacre.
In the town of Harmony, something unexplainable.
Hello?
Is happening.
Come here, you better check this out.
What is that? This January, prepare to witness.
What do you want?
The most frightening 3D motion picture event to tear through the screen.
It seems like this is something they've been discussing for a couple of years now as the future of the film-going experience. It makes it more of an event, and I know you have Cameron's picture at the end of the year, and goodness knows what he's up to, but that's another 3D project. Do you find that this is we're going to be seeing more and more of this technology in future films when it fits?
I think the technology has come such a long way since the 80s, and I really think that, you know, distributors and studios are going to work toward making this technology more prevalent in the future, just because, you know, it's in their interest to keep people in the theaters, and I think it's the kind of technology that's very hard to duplicate in the home environment. So that's their way of looking at it, but I find as a filmmaker, it's a wonderful way to immerse yourself in the filmmaking, you know, in terms of being an audience member, you get fully immersed in it. And it's quite different. I mean, I find it quite addictive looking at the dailies, looking for shots that we could really enhance the 3D. It was a really wonderful sort of journey from starting out knowing very little about it and then experimenting with it, and then by the end having a really good connection with the 3D and enjoying the process of finding those shots that are specifically more interesting in 3D, and then working toward making more of them and making them fit with the story and also the scares and jolts of the film.
Yeah. And the other side of this is the digital technology, and obviously that's arrived. There's no question about that. You've worked on both film and digital, obviously. Tell me about the benefits of digital and if there's anything still missing from that technology that you can't get from anything except film.
Well, I think the digital technology has come such a long way in the recent years. The Red camera was one of the camera systems that we used for the 3D. We'd have two Red cameras on a sled that would record each eye. And those cameras, I think, have wonderful interfaces. They produce a really terrific look and natural skin tones. And they were very user-friendly, very, very well-developed. And since the time that we shot the film, they've come even further. I really think there's been some significant enhancements in those cameras, the red ones, since the time we shot Bloody Valentine. The other cameras we had were very, very small and allowed us to move at great speed. Still very good cameras. They lacked a certain amount of ability to judge the image and massage it, so a greater challenge for me as a on the technical side in terms of being able to look at the dailies of what we're getting and those kind of things. But together, the two systems gave us the tools we needed to do great shots, to move the camera. We couldn't have done it without either system. We needed both to make it work. The drawbacks may be a little bit in quality. I still think film has a wonderful look to it. Sometimes the quality of the image would be a little bit different from film. I think film is more forgiving, has a greater latitude range still than digital cameras do. And I also think speed. The sensors on these cameras are slower than your average film stock. You could find a Kodak film stock that would be maybe 500 or an 800 ASA if you push it to stop, whereas these sensors are running more in the 250 range. So the light level also required for 3D is much higher because you're taking both cameras and putting them through a 50-50 mirror. So one camera bounces off the front side of the mirror, the other one shoots through, and so you lose a stop on each camera right there. So the combination of a slower sensor and the light loss with the mirror, you know, puts you down more in the 100 ASA range as opposed to 500 or 800 with film. So there's lots of trade-offs, lighting challenges, and judging challenges in terms of the digital equipment still.
Yeah. Where did this come from, your love of cinematography? When did that start for you?
I think when I was six, my parents had a Super 8 camera. They'd always film us at every Christmas running down the stairs, you know, running into the living room, opening presents, that kind of thing. And one year, my father, for whatever reason, decided to give me a roll of Super 8 film to shoot, and I took it and, you know, started to do what many other kids who have become future filmmakers started to do and shoot their friends. I shot my friends playing in various situations, Star Trek, Star Wars, these kind of things, drawing lasers on the film, animating plasticine, and it went on from there. And it was really a love at first sight kind of thing for me as a child. And then, you know, later on in high school and college, I diverted toward economics and stockbroking, but only for a very short time. And then I quickly realized my heart wasn't in it, and I wanted
right.
to do filmmaking. So I jumped in and pursued that without knowing much about it.
Were there particular photographers' works that inspired you and you clung to?
I think, you know, over the years, there's been so many films that have been inspiring. I think when I was younger, a film like The Changeling, I really, really enjoyed that film. And I don't think when I was younger I was as aware of the cinematography as a specific element. But I just think the look of the shots and the technology behind them as well, I've always found fascinating. I don't know if there's any one particular person or genre that I'm interested in. I think it's a broad range of sort of the art of cinematography as a whole that I found fascinating.
But you've worked in all these different genres, but you're particularly prolific as a cinematographer in the horror genre, it seems. Is that a genre that you've always particularly liked? You mentioned The Changeling.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that gives it away right there if I enjoyed The Changeling early on. I definitely do enjoy, I wouldn't say that, I don't know if it's the horror genre so much or psychological horror, as it were. Science fiction. I love, Blade Runner, and I remember seeing that film in the theater and just being in awe of what that cinematographer had done. And, so I guess definitely between science fiction and I also love political thrillers, though. So maybe early on I had a draw toward one or the other. But I guess I find that if you do something and people like what you've done, you'll get more of them. You get offered more of those kind of films.
Right.
So it's a little bit of both. I mean, I certainly enjoy the genres I work with, but then now and again you get to do a comedy, and that's really great as well.
Well, some of the movies or some of the genres that you just mentioned, the camera has the opportunity a lot of times to play a more active part. What's your take on that? Do you think that the camera should be another character in the scene? Or just observe? I know different DPs have different kinds of philosophies about that.
Yeah, I really believe that hopefully the camera movement is motivated by something that's going on in the scene, and ideally you're not just moving the camera for the sake of moving it. But at the same time, I've certainly broken that rule many times. I think it depends on the project and the audience expectation. I really enjoy moving a camera, and I think if it's done for the right reasons, that's always the best case scenario. Hopefully, like I say, it's not just moving for the sake of moving. If the actors are stationary and swirling around in circles for no reason, I'm not a big fan of that kind of thing. But I certainly do enjoy camera movement. I mean, if you see a David Fincher film, sometimes the camera's just dolling straight in, and there's certain aspects to camera movements that are quite wonderful. So,
right.
Yeah.
So tell me about the relationship with the director. And first of all, if there are, because especially with My Bloody Valentine, the original film was many years ago. Do you go back to that film with the director, or is that irrelevant to what you're trying to accomplish with this one?
I think it's very relevant as a starting point. Patrick Lussier, the director of My Bloody Valentine 3D, and I had worked two times previously together, and I think we both felt like we really understood each other, and we collaborated very, very well. He comes from an editing background and is a very strong director, and at the same time he's very open to ideas and loves the idea of collaboration. And I like to bring him a whole table full of ideas and let him pick and choose the ones that he sort of feels are best. So we did watch Bloody Valentine, the original, 81, separately, but we did talk about our feelings about it and what we wanted to do. One of the things that I liked about it is it has, and with the early 80s horror films, late 70s, they kind of have a look and a feel that's a little bit more grungy. And I was concerned at the beginning that this film, being a digital film, would look too clean and pristine, and I think somehow we were able to keep that look in it. But I think in terms of that particular film, we used it as a starting point, but Patrick knew he wanted to make a film that had rich in characters and also had a good plot storyline would carry through more than just having gore. And there's certainly elements of that film that we wanted to use, like the idea of finding somebody in a... there's a few ways that people are killed. And let me just say, there's a few ways that people are killed in that film that we have also taken and used, and a few sets that we've used the new film as well.
Yeah. Well, that film has really grown and cult status over the years. That's known as one of the best films of its genre at that time, which is fantastic. Have you watched this with an audience yet?
Yes, I did recently watch it with an audience, and I think people are quite surprised at what they see. And
yeah.
I think, actually, people this time around, as opposed to Friday the 13th, they find the 3D works very well and is very immersive, has an immersive quality, and that once you start to get into the film and get past the title sequence, you get into that and you forget about the fact that you're wearing 3D glasses and that the film's 3D, and you just fall into the filmmaking, you know, the watching of the film and the enjoyment of that, and get totally immersed by it. That's what people had said afterward.
You've also worked as an action photographer and an additional cinematographer on a lot of big blockbuster movies like I Am Legend and several of them. What does that entail?
Typically, we're doing the action sequences in the film, things that the first unit director and cinematographer have to, for various reasons, usually financial, hand over to another team, and we specialize in setting up and working with the first unit director team to get them exactly what they want in terms of the action sequences of the film. For I Am Legend, for instance, we shot the Mustang opening driving sequence, and as well portions of the attack of the vampire creatures later on, and other bits and thoughts. There's another sequence on the dock that we shot portions of, and I really, really enjoy doing action units. I'm one of the few people, I think, who's actually lucky enough to bounce back and forth between first unit cinematography gigs and, you know, relatively large-scale action cinematography.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in my position tend to specialize in one or the other. A first unit cinematographer might not want to go back and do second unit action stuff, and vice versa. The action guys kind of tend to specialize that in that and focus on it. And
right.
For me, I enjoy both. I mean, I think it's a great way to learn and be creative on another level. I mean, I think the action stuff is very visceral, and I certainly try to bring those skills that I learn and while doing those kind of projects to the first unit cinematography sequences I do as well. So I just enjoy both kinds very much. I mean, there's a certain energy that comes to shooting stunts and action, and a certain amount of strategic guesswork, I think, that goes into that. And
right.
It's a completely different vibe when you're doing first unit work with actors. And I think both are awesome.
How much contact and collaboration do you have with the actors when you're shooting them?
I try to hang back at the beginning of when they're blocking a scene, let the director and actors work things out. But, I mean, I'm there every step of the way. And depending on the director you're working with, some ask for or look for more creative support in certain areas, and others don't want, need, or require, or aren't interested. And I've worked with a full range of different directors, and I respect all of their choices either way. A lot of people sort of look for some collaboration in terms of the staging of the scene within the room or the set that you're in, and working with the actors a little bit. What I'll tend to do is watch what they do and see if I can bring some things to the table that might enhance the scene, that might open up some opportunities, because in the end we're not doing a stage play. We are trying to make it work for a camera and put the best version of it and put the audience perspective in the most interesting place for every given moment in the film. And
yeah.
So I work with a lens and a finder, and I try and find interesting angles and things that will help tell the story in the best way possible while working with the director and the actors. So I'll get involved with them, but not in the sense of performance.
Right, right. Is there a particular genre or kind of project that you're dying to take on?
Well, I mean, I guess I've always wanted to do a terrific political thriller, something like that, or I really am intrigued by politics. I think something set outside of North America would be very interesting as well. Like, I've done a lot of work in North America, and I'd love to do some more travel with work as well. So I'd say somewhere in those two are opportunities that I haven't quite had as much of yet as I'd like to do, but also just trying new things, trying new kinds of projects, and certainly trying 3D was a wonderful adventure. So any kind of new adventure, I think I'd be open to that.
Okay, that was Brian Pearson, the cinematographer of My Bloody Valentine 3D.
That was really good. That was really fascinating. So they used a red camera?
Yeah, they used a couple of red cameras, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I tell you what, the in terms of digital, I'm fascinated by how many movies are shot on digital and you don't even realize it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
It's so seamless now. I mean, that revolution is here. Let's get right to the next interview because I'm still under the weather and I can't stop coughing. And
okay, no, let's do it. Let's
go into a coughing fit.
Get some cough medicine.
Yeah, I just took some. Our next conversation is with the composer of the film. He's a great composer. He's done a great number of action films and horror films, and he has a very exciting sound, and we'll be hearing some of that sound a little later in the show, too. This is Michael Wanmacher talking about the process of composing music for My Bloody Valentine and films in general. Here it is. Tell me a little bit about how you first got into composing. Were you a musical child?
Not at all. Actually, quite the opposite. I didn't have a very musical upbringing, so to speak. I kind of got into it late in junior high, and mainly just started from playing in bands and things like that. Mm-hmm. I was in a school district that had a pretty well-renowned music program, but never really got into the curriculum-driven music stuff, but I just kept going into the kind of the band route, and during that time, you know, it took me through high school and into college, and during that time I met some people along the way who had broken off from doing their own touring and stuff to try to start doing commercial music for television commercials.
Mm.
And that led into doing some moonlighting work for them while I was working at an ad agency after just getting out of college. And one guy in particular, once he decided to expand his business, he offered me a full-time job, and I took it. And even though it was at a huge pay cut, it didn't matter. It didn't matter to me. I took it because I'd be able to be doing music full time.
Oh yeah.
And it just kind of grew from there. I started out doing news music and infomercials in that realm, and moved up to big client commercials for Apple and BMW, and then that parlayed into short films and some locally produced features, and then traveling back and forth to the coast. And I met some people in Los Angeles, and eventually those people that I met out on the coast, I parlayed those relationships into some work out here in Los Angeles and moved, and here I am.
Mm. So when you were in the band,
mm-hmm.
In school age, what was your instrument of choice?
Guitar. I've been playing for about 30 years. I used to sing, too. I learned piano along the way, entirely self-taught in everything I do, but at the time... Mm. At that time in high school and college, I was a child of the 80s, so I was playing in hair bands, and it was a lot of metal and playing guitar with just shredding, like playing as many notes as possible in the shortest amount of time. That was my goal in life, and it didn't really pan out, as you can see, but it did lead to some connections that brought me to doing this, so it's all good.
Oh, it led to a terrific career, I would say.
Yeah, thanks. It's funny because as I get older and the more bona fide rock stars that I meet or people who have been very successful on the record side of the business,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if that life would have been so great, actually. And you have to be really...
Yeah.
I mean, it would, but in another way, as you get older, it's great when you're in your 20s and 30s, but as you get older, you start getting in your mid, late 30s, that kind of thing, you want to have a home base.
Mm-hmm.
And the travel becomes a drag and because I toured all over the U.S. in the back of a van and that kind of thing. And, yeah, it can wear on you after a while. I know
I
people who love it, but most don't. So,
In terms of composing, it sounds like it's something that you pretty much picked up by doing.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no kind of formal training in terms of attending a music school or anything such as that,
no.
Was there?
No,
yeah.
There wasn't. I just learned the actual formal side of it, kind of the nuts and bolts of music theory and, you know, being able to read and write music out longhand, that kind of thing. And
mm-hmm.
I learned just by doing it. I mean, I basically
yeah.
would take scores out from the library and get recordings of them and try to follow along and learn how music was written out on the page. And reading guitar charts, I used to play in some side bands that would play in small clubs. So we'd play jazz and some other forms of music, and I would learn how to read charts that way. Or I was using software very early on that could do some notation stuff, and what I would do
mm-hmm.
is just input things that I was playing and look at how they came out as music and started to make those associations visually. And over time,
mm-hmm.
it became a secondhand kind of thing, but over time, I learned it. It just wasn't the normal route.
Well, we love composers on this show, and it seems like quite a few that we speak to, whether it's Terrence Blanchard or Mark Isham or any number of composers, they have someone that kind of mentored them and influenced them more than anyone else along the way. Did you have any figures like that?
As far as composers go, I would say there were probably three people. The first person, this guy who's still a friend of mine, Jerry Brunskill, was a person he was the one who hired me in my first full-time music job and kind of taught me the ropes. Even though it was in the realm of television commercials, it was definitely the same sort of drill, and it prepared me for doing film music. You're still dealing with clients, and you're working under really tough deadlines, and you have to work under a lot of genres, and you're constantly juggling multiple sessions, and there's a lot of pressure, and you learn all those things. So the transition into doing movies was much smoother that way. And I also met Alan Silvestri about the time that I was first starting considering moving to LA, and he was really critical in making the decision to make the move once and for all. I was able to travel back and forth a few times to LA from Minneapolis, where I was, to see some scoring sessions and get introduced to his crew, which is basically everybody across the board who's at the very top of the profession, and learn the ropes about doing scores at that level and getting ideas about things I needed to concentrate on in terms of my skill set and networking and just learning how to present myself to people so that it would be more conducive to getting work. He's just given me so much great advice, and he's such a nice guy. And I was a huge fan before that. It was because of my score geek status with Alan Silvestri that I got introduced to him in the first place. But
right.
That panned out and it led to another job that put me in touch with the Elfman brothers. I was doing a movie for Richard Elfman, and I got that job because Danny was too busy working on Men in Black at the time. They needed to find another composer, and I was thrown into a catacall with everybody else, you know, a bunch of other composers who were all LA-based, and I was in Minnesota at the time, and I ended up getting the job just because Danny felt that I had the strangest voice, and that's what the movie needed. And so so the relationship with both of them came out of that, and that's been really fruitful too.
Wow. From one score geek to another, who are some other of your favorite composers and some of your favorite themes that you always go back to?
I'm an old school guy pretty much. I probably have between cassettes, albums, and CDs and MP3s probably about 700 or 800 scores now.
Wow.
Playing around here, or maybe some more. But I still go back and listen to Jerry Fielding and Bernard Herrmann and Alex North and Dominic Frontier and people from that era. I'm really still into it. And John Barry, you can't really mess with those ideas. They still work. I mean, they need to be contemporized, you know, for today's marketplace. But in terms of their effectiveness in a film and how they approached everything as a, you know, from a dramatic aspect musically, it still is totally relevant. And I forgot to say Jerry Goldsmith, but he's probably at the top of the list. And
oh, he could do anything.
Yeah.
And he was so incredibly versatile.
Yes, and he's very experimental, too. He's very vanguard. Mm-hmm. He wasn't afraid to try anything, even if he fell flat on his face. And that happened a few times, and he was pretty open about that. But because of that devil-may-care attitude going into his scores, he always came out with, when it did work, it was magical. You know, it kind of moved the whole thing, the whole idea of scoring films. It kind of moved it together, or moved it forward. And you know, nowadays I still listen to a lot of Danny Elfman. I still listen to Alan Silvestri. I've always been influenced heavily by James Newton Howard. I still love, you know, the scores to The Fugitive and Waterworld. I think that's a wonderful score.
That is a beautiful score, yeah.
And I listen to John Powell a lot. I think he has an incredible voice as a composer. He's extraordinary in his range and especially from someone who comes from an electronic background, I think he's the best at putting an acoustic orchestra together with samples and making it work. His palette is huge, and it's very, very meticulous, and it's really effective. I mean, he came up with something with the Bourne scores. He came up with a whole new way of doing action films that, in a genre that everybody felt was really, you know, tread over too many times. And that score came out, and suddenly that was the way to do a kind of a crime-based thriller or something that was really considered a propulsive action score. Everybody was temping with the Bourne scores. He created something completely new there and where nobody thought anybody could. And he continues to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting how you use that word propulsive, because that's the word that comes to mind when I listen to some of your work. That's a sound that you, well, first of all, it works for the films that you compose for, but that's a sound that you have a particular affinity for, isn't it?
Yeah, I like motion. I like keeping the plot in motion, and I will slow it down when I have to, but I generally like to give every scene a pulse, just to keep the audience engaged and to keep their mind moving forward within the film. So they're always looking at it both from an external and internal standpoint, where there may not be much happening on screen, but in terms of external action, there isn't a car chase, there isn't something blowing up, there isn't a bunch of people running through a building, you know, chasing the bad guy. But at the same time, there could be a ton of stuff going on internally. If a person's in a really scary or tense situation, something like that, the music can reflect what's going on inside the character as well as outside. So I think that is well reflected in using a lot of a rhythmic basis for a lot of the music.
Yeah. Take me through your process. Say, with My Bloody Valentine, 3D, when that project comes to you and you meet with the director, first of all, what kind of questions are you asking on the outset?
How much music is there?
And there's a lot of music. There's a lot of music.
How much time do I have to do it? Which is funny, because A, there was a lot of music, and B, there was hardly any time to do it. But I knew that going in, and Patrick Lussier, the director, who's an absolute joy to work for, and I'm not just saying that because I work for him. I'm saying that because it's the truth. He had a very clear idea what he wanted, and he fought for me to be on that movie, and he wanted me on that movie from day one. And he had tempted with a lot of previous music that I had written. So in terms of style, it was very comfortable from the get-go. But we talked about it at length for a couple days before we were getting close to a director's cut, and saying we want specific motifs or themes for certain characters in the movie, and just the general palette of sound for the times that the killer is on screen doing his thing, and also to maintain a sense of real peril and a sense of fun in the movie at the same time. Because this is a return to more of a classic slasher movie mentality in terms of how the film's made. It's not overly stylized. There's no torture-type horror in it. It's not overly drawn out in terms of its visuals, that kind of thing. It's very much in the spirit of all the great slasher movies that came out in the late 70s and early 80s. There's a bad guy. There's usually some kind of murder mystery or love triangle involved. And the characters are generally a little bit older than high school kids. So we wanted the music to be to help drive that and make it fun for the audience. So it's a very big, relentless, somewhat traditional, you know, journey with a central theme for the main character. And I was using a lot of devices that are used in a lot of old horror scores, a lot of dissonance, a lot of atonality, really big orchestral, you know, low end, a lot of beef for when the bad guy is on screen. It's almost kind of arch, and stuck to using the more contemporary electronic elements to the quieter and more suspense-filled moments. We had discussions about that, and it was more about, in that case, with so little time, I just had to come back and decide on what sounds I was going to use and what sounds I wasn't, so that I wasn't guessing going in, decide on the template, and then I usually just run with it after that. I'll do a whole reel's worth of music and then sit down and watch the whole thing with the director, and if he feel, in this case, if he felt like I was going the right direction with it, he just kind of let me run with it. But I was sending him cues really fast, just because of the schedule we were on. I didn't wait to show him huge blobs after that. It was more like, I have two more cues done in Reel 2, and I would send him the MP3s. And since he's already a world-class editor, he was able to just, like, throw them in the movie on the fly, which was really helpful. And he's also very savvy about music, much more so than the vast majority of directors. He could cut his own temps. He can cut his own music for playbacks and things like that, where normally most directors would have a team of music editors working on that sort of thing. He's very, very quick about that.
Yeah, I would think just the process of being an editor, of editing, is a musical one. Largely.
Yeah, and he likes to work fast. It's just his thing. He likes.
Yeah.
He enjoys it. He's so much fun to work for. He really rallies people. You know, we knew we were up against it when the scoring part started. I had like 28 days to write all the music, and then an extra. It was about 105 minutes, and then a little less than a week after that to get it off to Skywalker for the mix where they were doing it up north. And it was pretty intense. But his whole tack in filmmaking is to let people do their jobs and make sure everybody's having a good time doing it. And he really knows how to, you know, create enthusiasm and a real sense of loyalty and everybody wanting to get the job done.
So is he? You said that you sent him cues because you were running against the clock.
Yeah.
Were there sessions where he was sitting with you and exchanging dialogue with you actually in the studio?
Yeah. When we had time, that's how we prefer to do it. We definitely did that the first playback where I showed him the principal themes and the score and the kind of feel I was going for during the kill scenes. He was here, and we sat, and the music editor, Josh Winget, was here, and we sat and went through each one and talked through it in detail. I mean, it was literally going through it one little section of it at a time and saying, you know, this is the right pace, this is the right flow, this is the right combination of instruments, or finding peculiar sounds in the palette I had created that he wanted highlighted more than others, that kind of thing. And we just compile notes, and then I was able to take that and apply that to the rest of the music I was doing. And he was working on getting his cut ready and doing his final cut ready and doing the 3D QC process at the same time. So we didn't get as much face time as we would have liked, but when we did, we made it worth the time we were there. And he wanted, for any screens he was doing for the studio, he wanted as much of the actual score mocked up and in the film. And I agreed that that was a good thing to do on that timeline. So the second I would finish a queue, I'd bounce it to an AIF file and just put it on a server, and he just put it in the movie, and it was like an assembly line getting it done.
Mm. Now, we talked to the cinematographer today. We did a pre-recorded with him, and so we talked extensively about the 3D process. In terms of the composing of the film, do you feel that that helped to shape or influence your score at all, the fact that it was a 3D experience?
I don't think it really affected it on an aesthetic level or kind of a artistic level. It's kind of a vague word I'm trying to come up with here, but nuts and bolts, it affected it a little bit, because 3D, by its very nature, in terms of what the film can handle, you know, quote unquote, when you're looking at it, what it can carry, like musically, what it can support, especially in the horror genre, is more than what it could support in a 2D world. We found when we were mixing it that we'd look back at some things that were 3D, and when you think the music was loud enough or maybe a little too loud, you'd realize, hey, you know, the movie, you could hit that a little bit harder, or you could bring this part of the cue up during this part where they're running through the woods or something, because the whole field of view in the movie kind of, it is enhanced. So there was this ability to enhance the music right along with it. So the music mix in the film is actually very loud, which I like, and Patrick likes loud music too, but it's louder than it would be in a 2D world. So that was the only difference, really, because I was always looking at either, as they say in the 3D world, I was looking at one eye or the other from day to day. I never saw a 3D picture until the very, very end.
Right. Let me ask you something, because I have enjoyed listening to the soundtrack score very much.
Thanks.
And it's a lot of work, obviously, just looking at the running time and the number of tracks on this score. But obviously your work is solely in service to the film.
Yes.
So how do you feel about the actual CD releases of these scores?
It's an interesting question. I was reading some people, some blogs a couple days ago, some people who also got advanced copies, other journalists, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's often the case with horror films, especially, or the kind of films that utilize a lot of, you know, boo moments or even dissonance or just loud kind of effecty music effects and clusters and things like that that aren't necessarily melodic. It's tough because in the movie you're trying to create a sense of real fear and dread and terror and hit all the moments and things like that. And it doesn't necessarily lend itself to doing something that's very melodic or flowing especially in terms of sitting down and listening to it. Whereas doing The Punisher, for instance, what lends itself more to writing, you know, big thematic melodic music, it plays better as a record. But yeah, with horror scores, I do it definitely to service the movie, and I know that there's a fan base out there for that kind of music. I mean, I personally like it. I get other people's horror scores and listen to it, but it's tough because it doesn't have a real kind of melodic base or center.
It's not something you put in and you sit back and relax to.
Exactly.
Necessarily, yeah. But when we talk to people, they do bring up the fact that some composers, and they consider this cheating somehow, they compose for the CD as well as for the movie.
Yeah.
And that's a danger, I would think. You have to avoid that.
That technically, you're not doing your job if you do that, because as a film composer, your first and foremost job is to write music that works in the film, and if you get a good album out of it that speaks to a lot of people, that's just gravy.
Mm-hmm.
But I never think of that when I'm working. Most of the people I know don't. They're just trying to do what works best in the movie, and it's great to get a CD release regardless, because there's always somebody who wants to listen to it or maybe doesn't want to listen to it, but it's better to just get it out there, and especially when you're a composer where I am, where you're on the front end of hopefully doing a lot of projects instead of having a lot of projects behind you, you just want to get stuff out there so people will listen to it, and you know, a temp editor somewhere might put it in a temp, or a director might get a hold of it and find that it works in their project, your style or something works in their project. So it's all about moving forward.
Right.
But you're right. Horror scores in general, or really genre-specific scores, tend to be not great albums because they don't have the same kind of melodic flow through that a big, you know, Alexander Desplat kind of score.
We just spoke with him last week about Benjamin Button.
Mm-hmm.
What a gorgeous score that
that
is too. Yeah. Oh.
Oh, totally. But it takes
yeah.
that kind of movie to create that kind of score. You know what I mean?
Is there a genre that you're dying to tackle, or a kind of project?
I would love to do a big sword and sorcery epic kind of thing. I think every composer would. It would be, you know, just to utilize a big acoustic palette with a choir and the whole nine yards, and do something that's, you know, really traditional with a big theme and kind of a musical work. Like Lord of the Rings, that kind of thing would be a dream come true. But at the same time, I love doing electronic scores. I'd love to find the ultimate project that's in a hybrid land between that and doing something really cool that utilizes electronics. I just like working in the genre world. I grew up loving monsters and comic books and manga and anime and cartoons, and that's where I come from. So anything that involves that, thinking man science fiction, I love that stuff. So if I'm working on that, I'm happy.
But when we talk to Brian Pearson, this probably relates this question. We spoke about the differences between digital and film.
Yeah.
And on the music end of that, could you explain a little bit when electronic music is called for, and when orchestra would be called for, and is electronic limited compared to what an orchestra can do for you?
It's a big question. I was trying to talk to somebody about this a couple weeks ago. I think both are equally valid nowadays. I'm glad that there are electronic elements in scores now, because it makes acoustic music more accessible to people who would normally not listen to it. If you have music that has strong rhythms in it, or that it sound very modern, or guitars, or something that's in the pop music pantheon, or what people would just generally listen to every day, and then you insert that into an orchestral environment, it makes orchestral music a whole lot more accessible to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also good for people who would normally listen to only orchestral music to hear some different brands of thought in terms of approaching something dramatically. So I think it's mutually a beneficial thing. For me personally, I like being able to do both, because there are times in movies, especially like My Bloody Valentine, where I really feel like using samples or creating some sound of my own. I like to record things in a natural environment and then put them into Pro Tools and make them into something tonal and organic sounding. I like to do that because I think, especially for tension or something scary, to have something in there that's odd or that you can't quite place your ear on in terms of where it's coming from as a source, makes it more unsettling. And electronics to me don't represent like a backseat to orchestra. I think they run side by side. They give the composer a complete template of thought and sound that they can use to convey their ideas. I think the best thing to do is to utilize both. In terms
right.
of expressing ideas melodically or emotionally, I don't think anything will ever beat the orchestra. There's just something about it that speaks to people on a very primal level. but forgetting sounds that speak to a particular genre or maybe try to sell a certain emotional point or emotional beat in a movie, electronics can definitely do that better sometimes. So I think it's better to approach it from both places.
It's lovely when they're both integrated.
Yeah.
With each other. It's
I have
a
very hard
sound.
Time with some music journalists, film music journalists, who poo-poo electronic music and think that for some reason it's not valid, because I have to tell you, I've done both scores that are completely electronic and completely acoustic, and just from a sheer journeyman, nuts and bolts, everyday working, getting it done kind of position, doing good electronic music is harder. It takes more time because you're creating something out of nothing, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with an orchestra, at least you know what you're working with. You're sitting down with nothing, and all you have is some plugins and maybe some synthesizers or something like that to just come up with something that's going to sell a point emotionally or dramatically, and you have nothing to base that idea on. You're kind of coming up with it completely out of the blue.
Right.
Whereas with an orchestra, there are so many zillions of devices you can use to sell an idea and use that as a starting point. And I also say good electronic music, because there are a lot of people out there who haven't taken the time to learn the finer points of programming. It's not just sitting there with your finger on a keyboard just playing a loop. There's much more to it. Coming up with something that's both electronic and quasi-organic at the same time, that fits within the realm of scoring films, is really, really hard. A score like Monster, for instance, that BT did, there's only a few people who could pull that off. That's like world-class programming. It's very, very hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
So those people deserve as much respect and regard as anybody else in the business.
Oh, absolutely. And it all comes down to what works for the film, you know.
Exactly.
Everything else is moot. Just two more quick questions for you.
Sure.
and then I'll let you go. You've been so generous with your time.
No problem.
The original My Bloody Valentine, was that referenced at all for you?
I went back and watched it for sure, but it's story wise. The new one is definitely very much told within the spirit of the first one. It's just kind of an update, but musically, the approaches are completely different. This is more, the new one is much more kind of in your face, really big, really aggressive, really relentless modern horror score. The old one is kind of a slightly cheesy small town. It's kind of a, I don't know, it's weird how it juxtaposes these scary little synth cues with this kind of backwoods bluegrass guitar thing, you know, to illustrate the mining community thing of back then. I mean, it worked back then, but there's this whole cheesy factor in the whole movie that makes it great. It's one of those so bad it's good kind of things.
Michael, I've had a great time talking to you, man.
Sure. Likewise. It's been great.
Come back anytime.
All right.
Okay, that's Michael Wanmacher. Great guy.
I mean, that was really. He said a lot of cool things on there. When he was talking about electronic music, does he also mean like Vangelis and Tangerine Dream and things like that?
That's really where it started, I think.
Yeah.
I think they really got the ball rolling on the electronic.
Okay.
Scoring.
He has great taste in a lot of the old composers and everything, film composers. It's wonderful to hear him and hear what influenced him and everything and his journey and everything. That was a really good interview.
And all of these guys have a mentor. It seems to me just a community that thrives on that kind of mentorship.
It's what Spielberg was talking about in his speech at the Golden Globes. I mean, it's so nice to hear that, because you don't hear, you know, generally we hear like it's every man for himself, you know, then blah, blah, blah. But no, it is nice to hear this. It is very refreshing.
I thought so, too. And so his was Alan Silvestri. And that's nice to hear. Speaking of nice to hear, we're about to hear a track from his soundtrack.
Oh, cool.
And it is, I believe I can safely say, Maybe I'm talking out of school, but I think it's at least one of his favorite tracks off the album.
Okay, cool.
Cues from the film, and it is the director's favorite cue from the film, according to him.
All right.
So there you go.
All right, cool.
Yeah, so, and he says it has a real, the name of the track is Prodigal Son. He said it has a real kind of, and it does, like a Nine Inch Nails kind of quality to
right.
it.
Right, okay.
Which marks the only time we've ever had something played on the show that has a Nine Inch Nails quality to it. But thank you all so much for joining in.
Yeah, thank
my
you.
My Bloody Valentine 3D, it actually screens tomorrow night in advance.
Yeah, it screens tomorrow night, and like if you have a 3D theater near you mm-hmm. that's showing it, it screens. So yeah, 10 o'clock. So yeah, if you have a chance, go see it. It sounds like that's the way to see it if you can. And
now, do you have a?
Yeah, I'm gonna try to see it in 3D. I mean, I'm not, you know, we have a couple theaters around here that will definitely show it just in the 2D, but it seems like something that really, if it's the whole thing was shot in 3D, I think it's
yeah.
You got to go check it out in that format.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But so you have those theaters around you. Surprisingly, I have one here in Podunk, you know, little Lakeland, Florida here.
Well, I think hopefully with the next couple of years, because this is the way, you know, to get people back in the movies so far seem to be recession-proof, but if you really want to get people out, if they're going to like the one movie, you know, they're going to go see, make it a special event. This is the way to do it. We've said that many times over the last year. So this is the way to do it.
Yeah. You know, isn't it amazing how they can watch playback, put on the glasses, and they can see immediate results. I mean, they
mm-hmm.
when they're shooting this movie. That's amazing to me.
That is.
Yeah. The digital technology, man, it's amazing.
I'm telling you, when we haven't seen anything yet, wait till the end of the year, Cameron and Avatar, I mean.
That's the big one.
That's the big one.
All right, let's play this track. This Sunday we got our DVD review show, and we might have a surprise in there, too.
Oh, really? Okay.
Maybe. And then upcoming shows we have shows themed around The Wrestler with special guests from that film. Wendy and Lucy, which is a great film
mm-hmm.
that needs to be discussed. And Oscar Roundtable, which we're trying a little something special this year with our Oscar Roundtable, so stay tuned for details on that. And upcoming shows in February that are going to be terrific, too. So appreciate everyone tuning in tonight.
Yes, thank you.
We're going to close the show with a track from Mr. Wanmacher's My Bloody Valentine 3D score. This is Prodigal Son. And thank you, Jerry.
Oh, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
And thank all of you. We'll see you back here Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern.